The dinner was collapsing, and the Duke of Sablewood could do nothing but watch it happen. At the far end of his long table, the Portuguese envoy had said something to the Russian attaché, who had misunderstood it entirely and replied in a clipped, offended tone that made the Austrian baron set down his glass. Casimir's own interpreter, a sweating young man hired at great expense from London, had gone pale and silent three courses ago, having discovered that his French was equal to the occasion and his everything else was not. The candles blazed in their silver branches. The crystal threw light across a table seated with the most important men in three foreign courts, and not one of them could make himself understood to the others, and the treaty that had brought them all to Sablewood under his roof was unravelling, course by course, into a thicket of cold misunderstanding. Casimir's jaw was tight. He had spent 2 years and a great deal of his fortune assembling this single evening. He was not a diplomat by nature. He was a blunt man who inherited a blunt man's duties, and he had believed that goodwill and a fine table would carry what his tongue could not. He had been wrong. He could feel the evening slipping, the envoys retreating behind stiff smiles, and he had no idea how to call it back. And at the middle of the table, almost forgotten, sat his wife. He had nearly forgotten her himself. Theodosia had been at Sablewood 3 weeks, and in 3 weeks he had heard her speak perhaps a dozen sentences, each of them soft and brief, and instantly swallowed by silence. Her family had sent her to him in a plain travelling gown with a plain trunk and a letter from her father that he had found, on reflection, almost unbearably cold. "The girl is biddable," the letter had said, "and gives no trouble, being of a quiet and unremarkable understanding. She will not embarrass your grace, requiring little and expecting less." He had read it twice and felt something he could not name, a kind of second-hand shame, as though he had been handed a thing her own people did not value and asked to be grateful for the saving of their trouble. He had married her because the contract was old and the alliance convenient, and because a man in his position needed a wife and had no time to court one. He had expected a meek nonentity. She had given him no reason, in 3 weeks, to expect anything else. She kept the morning room. She did not chatter. She watched a great deal, with grey eyes that were the only striking thing about her, and she said almost nothing, and he had filed her away in his mind as a quiet, dull, harmless creature and turned his attention to matters that mattered. Now the Russian attaché rose, half out of his chair, his face dark, evidently believing himself insulted, and the Portuguese envoy spread his hands in baffled apology that only deepened the offence, and Casimir thought, with cold clarity, that within the minute his treaty would be dead and 2 years wasted, and there was not one soul at his table who could prevent it. Then his wife set down her fork. "Forgive me," Theodosia said. She said it in Russian. The attaché stopped, half risen, and turned toward her. She did not raise her voice. She spoke a few quiet sentences, her tone even and unhurried, and Casimir watched the man's face change, watched the dark offence drain out of it and a startled, almost comical confusion take its place, and then something else. Respect. The attaché sank slowly back into his chair, listening. Theodosia turned to the Portuguese envoy, and in Portuguese, fluent, easy, faintly apologetic Portuguese, she said something that made him laugh, a surprised bark of relief, and answer her eagerly. She heard him out. Then she turned back to the Russian and rendered what the Portuguese man had said, plainly and exactly, and the misunderstanding that had nearly broken the table dissolved in the space of three sentences. Casimir did not move. He was not certain he was breathing. The Austrian baron said something then, leaning forward, testing a quick, dry remark in German, the kind a man makes to see whether the marvel is real or a trick of one lucky phrase. Theodosia answered him in German without a pause, and added something that made his eyebrows climb. And then she was speaking French to the man on his left and Italian to the man beyond him, turning down the table like a musician moving along the keys of an instrument, and the cold air of the room was suddenly, impossibly, full of conversation. She did not falter. She did not grope for words. She moved from tongue to tongue as easily as another woman might move from one guest to the next, and each man she addressed leaned toward her as though warmed at a fire, and the treaty that'd been dying 3 minutes before sat up and began, quite to breathe. Casimir watched his wife, his quiet, dull, harmless wife, the unremarkable creature her own father had been so relieved to be rid of, hold the whole of his ruined evening in her two hands and set it gently right, and he felt the floor of his certainty drop away beneath him. There was a Greek scholar near the foot of the table, an old man who had said nothing all evening, and who now murmured something low, almost to himself, in a language Casimir did not recognize at all. Theodosia heard it. She turned, and she answered the old man in his own ancient Greek, and the scholar's lined face broke open into pure astonished delight, and he pressed his hand to his heart and bowed his head to her, as though she were a queen. 7 languages. Casimir counted them later, lying awake. That night he only knew there were a great many, and that his wife possessed them all, and that he had sat across a breakfast table from this for 3 weeks and seen nothing but a silent girl who gave no trouble. The dinner did not collapse. It became, instead, the finest evening of its kind that anyone present could remember. The envoys talked late and freely through her. Agreements that had seemed impossible at the soup were sketched out over the wine. The Russian, Attach, departing, took Theodosia's hand and told her, in Russian, and then again haltingly in English, so that her husband might understand him, that she had the gift of 10 ambassadors and that the Tsar himself kept no one half so able. The Greek scholar would not leave until she had promised to write to him, and through all of it she remained exactly what she had been, quiet, composed, unhurried, lifting each man's meaning across to the next, without ever once making the cleverness her own. She did not perform. She served. It was, Casimir thought, watching her, the most extraordinary thing he had ever seen. When the last carriage had rolled away down the avenue and the great doors were shut, he found her alone in the empty dining room, blowing out the candles one by one. She started a little when she saw him and folded her hands, and that old reflexive silence came down over her face like a shutter. "You did not tell me," he said. His voice came out rougher than he intended. "You did not ask, Your Grace," she said quietly. It was not an accusation. That was the worst of it. There was no reproach in her at all, only a plain statement of the way things were and had always been. No one ever asks. It was easier at home, not to be much. "My sisters are the clever ones, you understand, the accomplished ones. I was the quiet one. I learned long ago that a woman who knows too much much makes a poor showing in a drawing room, and an uneasy daughter, and a worse prospect for a wife. So I learned to be still." She looked down at the candle in her hand. "I did not mean to deceive you. I only meant to be no trouble, as I was sent to be." Casimir crossed the room to her. He took the candle gently from her hand and set it down. "Where did you learn them?" he asked. "The languages." A faint color came into her cheeks. "Books, mostly. My father's library was large, and no one minded what I read there, because no one expected me to read anything at all. The Greek I taught myself from an old grammar I found in the attic. The Russian came from a governess who stayed only a year before they sent her off. I would not let her go without learning all she knew. I had a great deal of time," she said, with the smallest, saddest smile, "and very little company. One must do something with the hours, when no one wishes to spend them with you." He stood looking at her in the guttering light, and he thought of 3 weeks of silent breakfasts, of all the things he might have asked her and had not, of a girl who had sat in attics teaching herself the tongue of Homer, because the people who should have loved her could not be bothered to find out what was in her. And he felt a slow, deep anger, not at her, never at her, but at every soul who had looked at this woman and seen nothing himself first among them. "They told me you were unremarkable," he said. "I know what they told you." She said it without bitterness, which made it worse. "It is what they have always told everyone. After a while one believes it. It is simpler to believe it." "Theodosia," He had never said her name aloud before, he realized. It felt strange and right in his mouth. Tonight you saved 2 years of my work and a treaty that three courts had given up for lost. You did it without raising your voice and without taking a particle of the credit, and the cleverest men in Europe bowed their heads to you over my own table. There is not a man in England who could have done what you did tonight. There is not, I begin to think, a man in England fit to fetch your books. He shook his head slowly. Unremarkable. I have never in my life been so wrong about anything. Her composure cracked, just slightly, a quick brightness in the grey eyes swiftly mastered. You are kind to say so. I am not being kind. I am being accurate. I find I have a great deal to be accurate about, where you are concerned, and 3 weeks of catching up to do. He paused. I should like to begin, if you would permit it. She looked up at him, and for the first time since she had come to his house, she did not look away. After that, everything was different, and the difference was made of small things. He moved her place at table. The far quiet seat became the seat beside his own, and the silent breakfasts filled day by day with talk, for he discovered, once he began to ask, there was no end to what she knew, and that under the long-trained stillness was a mind quick and dry and quietly funny, a mind that had been waiting all its life for someone to be curious about it. He asked her about Russia, and she told him things his ambassadors did not know. He asked her about the Greek poets, and she recited them to him by the fire, softly translating as she went, until the words ached. He brought her books, armfuls of them, in every language he could find, and watched her face when she unwrapped them, the disbelieving wonder of a woman who had never once been given a gift chosen for who she truly was. He gave her the great library at Sablewood for her own, with a key and a fine wide desk by the south window, and leave to send for any volume in Europe. He let it be known, quietly and then not so quietly, that the Duchess of Sablewood was the most accomplished linguist in the kingdom, and he watched with a fierce private satisfaction as the same society that had no time for the quiet Wren girl began to clamor for an hour of her conversation. Foreign ministers wrote to her. The old Greek scholar came twice a year and called her his finest pupil, and her family, who had sent her away in a plain gown to be no trouble, wrote stiff and astonished letters that Casimir took quiet, unholy pleasure in answering on her behalf. But it was not her brilliance he came to love, in the end, though he was endlessly proud of it. It was her. It was the way she still set down her fork before she spoke, out of an old habit of making herself small, and the way he could now reach across and cover her hand, and watch her remember that she need not be small any longer. It was the steadiness in her, the deep unshowy kindness, the patience of a soul that had learned in a hard school to expect little, and had never once grown bitter for it. He had been given a wife in a cold letter, like a parcel of small value, and he had unwrapped her slowly over a lifetime, and found a treasure beyond the reckoning of every fool who had handled her and not known what she was. One winter evening years on, he found her at her desk by the south window, a dozen open books around her and her pen moving, and he stood a while in the doorway only to look at her, the lamplight in her hair, the loose strands she never could keep pinned, the quiet absorption of a woman entirely at home at last in her own gifts and her own house and her own life. She glanced up and smiled at him, the easy, open smile that had taken him a year of patience to earn, and that he had never once stopped being grateful for. "You are staring, Your Grace," she said. "I am," he agreed and came to her, and bent to kiss the top of her bright head. "I find I never tire of it. I spent 3 weeks under this roof believing I had married a silent, unremarkable woman." He drew her up out of her chair and into his arms, there among her books and her seven languages and the warm lamplight. "And it has taken me the rest of my life, and will take me all the years still to come, to find the words in any tongue at all for how wrong I was, and how the quietest creature they ever cast off turned out to be the whole of my high heart's good fortune." She had no answer for that, not in Greek, nor Russian, nor any of the seven. She only laid her head against him and held on, in the one language that had never needed any words at all.